Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today we have a great show for you. We have William Pepper on, who will talk about the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, and then we have our good friend Ray McGovern, who's going to give us an update about what happened to him in a speech that Hillary Clinton was giving at George Washington University. William Pepper, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Good to be with you, Cindy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's been a while. I've wanted to have you on the show for quite a while, so I'm glad you can make the time to do it for us.
Okay. No, I'm pleased to do that.
Okay, so we're just going to get right into it. I've been reading up on your life, getting better acquainted with you this morning, and I'm very impressed with all the work that you've done in your lifetime career for justice.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Cindy. I guess I'm just one of the folks out there in the field trying to make some kind of an impact in terms of a lot of the problems that we all face.
Well, you've had a very legendary and important impact on the problems that we're facing now, to expose them, to put to shine a light on the disease of this system that we live in and live under. But, you know, first of all, I'm very interested in your association with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And it's said that your work and friendship helped influence his increasingly radical views on the Vietnam War, and you were present at his Beyond Vietnam speech at Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967, which was exactly a year before his assassination in Memphis on April 4th, 1968. And April 4th, I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's a very meaningful date for me and my family, because in 2004, that's the date that my son Casey was killed in Iraq, on April 4th, 2004. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we call it 04-04-04. And so...
I didn't know that.
That was a long introduction to this question I have for you. So, anyway, what was the process in Dr. King's writing that speech? And he knew and was fully aware that he was going against many people in the civil rights movement and faith community of that time who wanted to stay away from that issue, who wanted to just keep it all about civil rights. And you were there to witness and participate in the struggle that he had. What was that like?
Well, it was in some ways exhilarating, in other ways very frustrating. I only knew Martin King that last year of his life. As you know, was a journalist in Vietnam, and when I wrote a piece for Ramparts magazine in January of '67, that caught him, and I think the article and the photographs that I was able to take on the ground in Vietnam moved him. So he asked me to meet with him, and I did. Sometime fairly shortly after that article was published, he was shocked and really horrified by the extent of the war crimes that were being committed against the civilian population of Vietnam. It wasn't generally known, of course, because the media then was more open. Less control was consolidated than it is today, and
right.
That's why programs like yours, Cindy, are very important. On the 4th, Martin made that great coming out speech, and he knew that, as you stated, he knew that he was going to be attacked from the right and the left, not just editorially in the mainstream press, but by civil rights leaders as well, who were afraid that they were going to lose funding that they treasured from the federal government. And of course, that is what happened in terms of Martin. Then on the 15th of April, It was agreed that I would, in a rally that culminated at the United Nations, that I would push hard for the creation publicly of a third party and a King Spock ticket. And that was, we then went in heavily into the political arena, and because Martin felt that only this way could he get a platform sufficiently strong and stable enough to get the attention of the American public, because he had always been known only as a civil rights leader. Now he became, his view of the American system and the war economy, the kind of permanent war economy, Cindy, which of which your son was a victim, and which you've campaigned against ever since, but it's inevitably been a part of our virtually all of our lives. And he saw that, and that's why he called America the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. And he just was determined to struggle against it. And he was attacked from every side. And even within his own organization, he met serious opposition. But as it's turned out in my work, the indications are pretty clear that his organization, SCLC, was in fact infiltrated, and that a number of the people whom he thought he could trust were in fact functioning on behalf of the administration.
Do you feel comfortable in exposing those people? Have they been exposed in other means of media?
Well, to some extent, some of them have been exposed. A senior aide to Abernathy, Jim Rutherford, was exposed as a direct informant. In other cases, it became much more subtle than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a third book coming out on, which is the end of the story, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And it's coming out, and it'll probably be a better part of another year. And in that, I've been given information about fairly high-profile people who, in fact, were working for the government. And betraying Dr. King. What I'm in the process of doing, though, is corroborating that information, because I've been given it by an informant who has decided that he's going to reveal that. But I, you know, you need more than one source, and so I'm working on corroboration. But I think we will be getting it. So, yes, I think he was surrounded by traitors, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And by people who just simply were not who they appeared to be. So he had this enormous struggle, Martin, and he waged it courageously up to the last, you know, that during that last year of his life. And finally, the major straw was not just his opposition to the war, but it was the fact that he was going to lead 500,000 people to Washington. And they were afraid that would turn into the kind of event that we've just seen take place in Cairo and Alexandria.
Right.
The army didn't have sufficient forces to put down what they believed would become a rebellion. And Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more for Vietnam. And they didn't have those troops, and they certainly didn't have the troops to bring into the capital to put down the kind of revolution they thought would take place. Remember, in 68, the world was on fire. There was a virtual revolution in France and the streets of Paris that de Gaulle only was able to undercut when he was able to convince the communists and the leaders of the labor unions to go back to work and leave the students out there by themselves. Otherwise, there might have been a revolution in France. So the people there was a great deal of concern on the military side about a potential revolution in this country.
Well, speaking of that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has become an icon of the civil rights movement here in the United States, and his burgeoning anti-war, not just anti-war, but connecting militarism to racism and poverty in this country, of course, was, you know, something that is very seminal, where I think, you know, even in my own case, I was allowed to speak out against George Bush and the Iraq War, but when I started to connect the dots and realize and speak out against the systemic problems in this country with imperialism and capitalism and things like that, it, of course, is when I was started to be attacked by all sides. But today, we see in the celebrations of Martin Luther King Jr. Day is, I believe, a very sanitized version of Dr. Martin Luther King, who was starting to listen to people like you about a more militant, maybe, vision of the way to challenge this empire. And what do you think about this sanitized version of Dr. King today?
Well, I think it's terrible, but in a sense inevitable. If the forces that run this republic at the present time, and the media that they control, can portray him as a civil rights leader, and just limit him to the struggle for equality for black people, that serves their purpose. They can they can build monuments to him, name schools and bridges after him, and things of that sort. And that's what we do, isn't it? We kill them and then we monumentize them in a sense. So that'll serve their purpose. But it just deflects and distracts people from the extraordinary growth and inequality of wealth and the social, economic, and cultural deprivation of huge numbers of the people in this country. You know, Cindy, I was a kid and I ran Bob Kennedy's campaign when he ran for the Senate in New York, in Westchester County, New York,
right,
which is a very large Republican center. And I didn't like Bob Kennedy at that point because I felt he was isolated from the poor people, the wretched of this country. But the Bob Kennedy they killed 4 years later, whom I didn't know, when we buried Martin, the night we buried Martin, he invited me up to his suite to talk about the presidential campaign, and I just didn't go. I said, I've had enough of politics. And I regret that now because I think he had been to West Virginia and Mississippi, Arkansas, and he had seen people living on dirt floors. He'd seen children without shoes. He had seen poverty as he never understood it to exist in America. And he had apparently greatly changed and altered his views. And so I regret that I didn't see him at that point in time. But there is this isolation, and the media will separate and will just keep the truth away from masses of people who do not understand how the really desperately poor people live in their many millions in America. We've never signed the Second Protocol of the Civil and Political Rights Covenant because it calls for social, economic, and cultural rights.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy so long as we talk about civil and political rights because the forces that run the society are able to manipulate the civil and political system in order to perpetuate their control. So the democracy really is a sham. But when it comes to social, economic, and cultural rights, we don't want that. That goes straight to the heart of the capitalist ethic, which has in our lifetimes has emerged with such enormous greed and excess that it's virtually unspeakable in terms of the conditions it has imposed on people.
And reading about you and getting to know you better this morning, I read that you you said that you had had it with politics, understandably so, you worked really hard. And earlier in the interview, you said that Martin Luther King Jr. Was going to run for president, and you said Spock was the running mate. Of course, that's Dr. Benjamin Spock, who was also a major peace activist, political activist during that time. So you dropped out after the assassination. Understandable, you know, totally understandable. And I think I read for about 9 years. You believed the official story that James Earl Ray was the lone assassin of Martin Luther King Jr., or you, I don't know if you believed it, but you just didn't really dwell on it that much. In your research, I think you've discovered, and your research and your, work for justice for the King family, I think you discovered, and your work with James Earl Ray, that wasn't so. So who do you know really killed Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, Martin King was killed by a professional a sniper, and he was a member of the Memphis Police Department, and he was hired. It was a hired gun. James Earl Ray was a patsy. James was set up. He was actually profiled. We now know he was profiled at the request of Edgar Hoover, and allowed to escape from the Missouri State Penitentiary at Jefferson, and then kept on a kind of long leash. He was allowed to move into Canada, encouraged to go into Canada, and he was picked up there by a handler named Raoul, who, there's been so much, so many lies told about this fellow that, of course, he didn't exist. He was a fantasy of imagination of James, but he exists, and he's alive to this day, and he controlled James, and he moved him around the country until the time came for him to move him into Memphis to be set up as the patsy for the assassination. Martin was initially to have been killed in Los Angeles, and for reasons that have not until fairly recently become clear, the site was moved to Memphis. So they kept James in Los Angeles for a long time, and then when they changed the venue for the hit, they then moved him. They had him drive back to New Orleans, and eventually moved him up into Memphis. So but you're quite right. I mean, I didn't even think about it for 9 years, and then Abernathy in 1977. Said to me, or contacted me, and said, "Why don't you? I'd like to go up and see you interrogate Ray in front of me." And I thought he'd gone round the bend. I said, "Well, it's not a Ralph. Didn't you? You know, you had some second thoughts about him." He said, "Well, I'd just like to see you." And I said, "Ralph, I knew nothing about the case, and it's going to take me, you know, months to read everything I can and get up on it so that I could do a meaningful interrogation." I did that. And eventually, in August of 78, I went to the prison, to Brushy Mountain, and interrogated, I guess is a better word, James Earl Ray for 5 hours. And at the end of that, we became convinced he wasn't the shooter. But we didn't know if he played a meaningful role or not. But we didn't. He raised so many questions that I started to go quietly into Memphis spent a lot of time on the streets in that South Memphis area, in the bars, and slowly began to develop a picture of what went on. But it took from 78 to 88, it took all that period of time for me to become convinced that James had no knowing involvement in the crime. And I told him if he kept asking me to represent him, and I said I wouldn't until I became convinced. So it took 10 years. Mm-hmm. I represented him the last 10 years of his life, from 1988 to 1998, letting with the family knowing what I was doing. and why I was doing it. And then eventually, of course, James died in 98. We never did get a trial for him.
Amazing.
But we brought a civil action against Lloyd Jowers, who was one of the people involved in the assassination. And that case was tried over 30 days with 70 witnesses giving evidence in Memphis. And most of the country, Cindy, do not know that it ever took place because the media just blacked it out.
Right.
But it took the jury 59 minutes to find that there was a conspiracy involving agents of the government of the United States, and James Earl Ray had no knowing part of the assassination. 59 minutes after hearing all that evidence, that's all it took them. So it was but the whole trial laid out how King was killed and why he was killed, and why they felt they had to get rid of him at that point in time. But Americans don't know that about him at all.
Pardon me. As a matter of fact, this Lloyd Jowers, who I worked at a cafe that was in the motel or the boarding house or whatever across from the motel, he actually went on primetime television with Sam Donaldson and admitted to it, didn't he?
Yes. He admitted that he was involved. We had four witnesses, and we were going to press for an indictment, and he knew. I had broken down some people around him, and he knew that we had this evidence, and so he thought he'd better come out and come clean, and he thought that if he did that, he could make a deal. He really was afraid of an indictment. You know, frankly, between all of us, there was never a chance they would indict him. They were going to cover this up forever,
Right.
And, you know, indicting him would have opened up the can of worms. That's why we had to bring the civil action. That was the only way we could get the truth out.
And what you've worked also with the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, who was assassinated in Los Angeles, and just a few months after Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm.
And what do you think is the importance of getting the facts of these cases and exposing the lies or exposing the cover-ups and the conspiracies? What relevance does it have to us today in 2011?
I think it has a great deal of relevance because if you show the pattern of government involvement in these killings, it shows it really the dark side of a power structure that is determined ultimately to use the politics of assassination in order to maintain their control over the society and the wealth of the society. You may not know, because we haven't done a lot of publicity on it at all, but I am the lead counsel for Sirhan Sirhan.
I did read about that.
Yeah, and the reason I took that on, and I'm not a conspiracy specialist by any means, but they came to me, people associated with the Kennedy assassination, and showed me new evidence that has come out that made it so clear that Sirhan did not and could not have killed Bob Kennedy that I decided when I saw that I said this is another one. In fact, in many ways, this is much more blatant than the assassination of Martin King, because Sir, I have 12 witnesses who said Sirhan was always in front of Bob Kennedy.
Right.
About 2 feet to 5 feet in front. And Bob was hit with two bullets in the back, and the one that killed him in behind his right ear was fired less than an inch from his right ear. The bullets left powder burns, which meant they were all fired at close range. So Sirhan could never have done that. There were 13 shots fired in that pantry. That now has been confirmed by audio technology of a tape recording of the tape recorder that was running at the time. And that technology was not available back in 68. So this is effectively very new evidence. And 13 shots meant there had to be two guns, since Sirhan's gun only had 8 bullets. And his hand was pinned to a table, steam table, after the first two shots.
Right.
And he just kept pulling the trigger, and the bullets went all over the place. But nevertheless, his hand was actually pinned to the table, much less being possibly an inch behind Kennedy's ear. So that case, and the autopsy report is about the best evidence one can have that shows how Kennedy was killed. So I decided that yes, we'll take that case on, and we're trying hard to also develop a way of getting the truth out about it.
Well, I had Australian journalist John Pilger on my show last year, and he was one of the witnesses there who said that there were shots being fired from behind him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
who did you have on?
John Pilger.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, he's an Australian journalist who was covering the Kennedy campaign. And so he was there in the pantry, and he said that a bullet just, like, whizzed by his, close to his ear in the pantry.
And that's interesting. Well, Pilger is quite a, of course, he's a reputable journalist, and he's been
very
effective.
Yes, so.
Yeah, and he's his name, though, has very interesting, Cindy, because his name has never surfaced as being present in the pantry, and no statements have been taken that I've seen in any official records or even unofficial records from him. So it's good to hear about.
Oh,
him,
good! Right? I just gave you a lead.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very
awesome.
Useful to speak
Yay.
With him. I have a lot of time for his work anyway.
So we just have a few minutes left. We could talk about all of this stuff forever, and I hope you come back on the show again soon so we can continue this conversation. But, my last question is that, we have seen little improvement since Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, and the evils of the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism continue. And, we see uprisings in the Arab world. And do you think that this system that can be changed, or do you think that it's been insulated enough with its lies and patriotic jingoism and this, like you said, this planned use of assassination? Do you think it's insulated here enough, or do you think that we can really change the system?
No, I think the system is going to collapse almost of its own weight. And you need both objective and subjective conditions to match at the right time for a revolution to take place. I think as unthinkable as it is that the conditions are in America are reaching a point. The excesses of the system. This is not easy liberal capitalism that resulted in the development of a strong American middle class. This is capitalism at its most extreme in terms of greed and excess. And I think it has within it the seeds of its own destruction. I think the numbers of people who are living in tents all over this country have lost their homes. The millions who have lost their jobs are not going to get them back.
Right.
The millions and millions of young people who are really do not have anywhere to go, in many ways, are increasingly going to mirror the situation that exists in other parts of the world, like Egypt. I think the system can be changed, and it will be changed, because I think the conditions of revolution are rising to the fore in America. And it is only a matter of time. And, of course, the media is in many ways the greatest enemy, because mainstream media keeps its lid on all of this. You know, back in the 60s, when my article came out, Bill Atwood was editor of Look magazine. You probably remember that. And Bill asked me to come sit with him And he wanted to put into Look magazine everything I knew about Vietnam and had seen in the country, and use the photographs and all of that. And the day I walked in, he said, "Oh, by the way, I want you to know that you may be pleased to know or displeased to know that I had a visitor last week." And I said, "Who was that, Bill?" And he said, "Well, it was Averill Harriman." And I said,
"Wow."
"And what?" "Yeah, he came in from Washington to see me." I said, "Well, what did Governor Harriman want to see you about?" "Well, he said he carried greetings from the President of the United States. And the President also had a favor to ask of me." And I said, "What was that?" And he said, "Well, the favor was that I never publish anything that you write." And he said, "How old am I, 28, 29? I said, "Well," he said, "now, how does that make you feel that President of the United States is so concerned that we might publish something that you write on this war?" And I said, "Well, I'm more interested, Mr. Atwood, in what you said to Governor Herman."
Uh-huh. And said, what did he say?
He said, "Well, I told him that I was going to see you next week, and if I believed what you had to say, that we were going to publish." And he said, "Oh, by the way, give the President my best regards."
So, you know, that's the kind of journalism that we could use these days.
We don't have
sure
that.
Too.
And, well, do you know
not
what happened? The next week, he had a similar session with Jim Garrison from New Orleans.
Right.
And that session, I was with him for about 6-7 hours. That session went on, his session with Garrison, Chandler Brassard, the associate editor, told me all this. The session with Garrison went on into the evening, and they went to dinner. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, he called Bob Kennedy. And he said, "Bobby, I've just been shaken to my boots by what the district attorney in New Orleans has told me about the killing of your brother and the involvement of the agency." And Bobby said, "We know, but I have to get the White House in order to make this right." That was about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
4 o'clock in the morning, Bill Atwood had a heart attack. Same morning. He left Look magazine, never returned.
Wow.
My piece, of course, was never published. Garrison's
right.
was never published. And Chandler Brassard, who was the facilitating editor, was fired. So I don't put anything. I think Bill Atwood was shaken, and maybe had a weak heart. Anyway, I don't put anything sinister necessarily behind that, except the fact that this was a good and loyal citizen of the Republic, and he was just so shaken by what he had heard over the last 2 weeks that it seemed to be too much for him. But, you know, that's the way it is. You know, you might be interested in knowing that I'm lead counsel to and the expert witness to the courts in Spain on the prosecution, the effort to prosecute officials of the Bush administration for war crimes.
Oh, yes, I'm very interested in that. I didn't know that. And as a matter of fact, we were trying to get somebody on for a future show to talk about that.
Yeah. I've written the opinion, and I've testified in Judge Garzon's court. The opinion has been translated into Spanish and is lodged as a part of the official file. It's a legal opinion which justifies the use of what we call universal jurisdiction for prosecution. That means if the host country of the criminals chooses not to prosecute them, as Obama has done,
right,
then any other treaty signatory has an obligation to consider that prosecution. And the Spanish have been doing that. Unfortunately, the American government has put such pressure on them that this whole thing is just ground to a halt, and I don't know where it is at this point in time.
But, well, hopefully we can have you back on to talk about that, too. I lied a little bit. I do have one last question for you.
Sure.
You brought up Obama. Of course, much has been made about the color of Obama's skin. And do you think that Obama is just another tool and gift of the ruling class to help reinforce the system? Or, in your opinion, is Barack Obama a fulfillment of the legacy of such you know, brave people as Martin Luther King Jr.?
I think he's a tool. I think he's been carefully chosen and selected. I think he has agreed to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
He's far more dangerous than George Bush, in my view, because you knew where you stood with Bush, and he was not that that bright or that quick.
Right.
But this guy is bright. He's articulate. And the fact that he's black certainly gives him an edge with a whole segment of the American minority population, who should be outraged with his conduct and with his sellout.
Exactly.
But it's very difficult. The first black man to occupy the White House. It's very understandably difficult for leaders of the black community to overcome. The fact that there is now a black man in the White House, and to see him as effectively a traitor to the cause. I mean, they can turn their backs on the 2 million. We have over 2 million people in prison, as you know, in this country.
Yes.
The vast majority of them are either black or Hispanics, and we have stripped, emasculated the leadership of the black communities of this country by incarcerating some of the brightest and the best in those communities. And Obama is fully aware of all of this and fully aware of all of the sinister actions of the government, and in fact has become a purveyor of war in his own right. So I don't know what else one can say. They've chosen wisely. I mean,
mm-hmm.
When you think about it, it's not reasonable to underestimate the power of the forces that run this society. It simply is not. They are very clever, and I've known them. I've personally known them over the years. I've been close to the Rockefeller family in earlier times,
mm-hmm.
and I guest up at the Cantico any number of times when Nelson Rockefeller was governor, and had long discussions with Nelson. And he chose the discussions because he was interested in my future and in my going down a certain road, which he made it appear to be very, very attractive. But somehow there was something inside me that said, this is wrong. This is not what I want to do with my life. I don't want to be a handmaiden to these forces. And that was a choice that I made, for better or for worse, back in those days. But these people are very clever, and very bright, and they're very seductive. And I would add
ruthless, I think.
Yeah, and ruthless. There's no question about that.
Well, William Pepper, this has been a fascinating conversation for me. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope our listeners are enlightened by it. But is there a website that my listeners can go to get more information about what we've been talking about?
Well, I don't have a website. I don't go on Facebook. I try not to do any of that stuff. But they can, just by putting my name into Google, they're all of the range of activities. Somebody did put a website up in my name, and it has some things on it, but one can go just Google me, and a lot of the work is there. I mean, I represent some of the victims of 9/11 as well, and that's a whole other area that, Cindy, we should talk about another time. Because
I can't wait. Yes.
Yeah,
thank you, William Pepper, for being a guest on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
You're very welcome, and I have a great deal of admiration for you and everything you've tried to do, in your time. Please keep up the good work.
I will, and you too. Thank you again.
Thanks a lot.
That was my guest, William Pepper, and trust me, we will get him back on soon to further explore all of these amazing and interesting things that he's involved in. Our next guest is our dear friend, Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
It's great to be back here, Cindy.
It's always great to hear your voice. So you're causing quite a stir lately. Can you tell my listeners what happened to you when you went to a talk given by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton this past week?
Yes, I got a ticket, and I went to see her in a small auditorium in at George Washington University. And I wore my Veterans for Peace shirt underneath my outer garment just to be prepared. And in the event, as I saw the extremely warm welcome, stormy applause greeting her, I thought that it probably was necessary for someone to do something that would show that not everyone agrees that it's great to start these wars, to continue these wars, to put several lives and thousands of people in jeopardy of being killed. And so I decided that might be me. And so I took off my outer shirt, turned my back on the speaker, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and simply directed my gaze at the back, standing at parade rest, so to speak, not saying a word, and thought that this is pretty meaningful, a very unobtrusive way to do this. And all of a sudden, about 2 minutes and 10 seconds, they tell me, into the speech, I was blindsided by this. Gosh, I say I was huge manhandled. This guy was really big. Grabs me, pretty much carries me over the four women who were sitting between me and the aisle, and drags me out with a sort of a token presence by the GW police force out into the street. Really, they close the door so no press can come in, come out. And I was subjected to some pretty brutal treatment at the hands of these folks.
So they were private security, or was it somebody who was assigned to protect the Secretary of State?
As usual, Cindy, you ask exactly the right question. We don't know. One was the big guy I described was plain clothes. He looked like an NFL reject. And the other guy seemed to be just taking orders from him. So what we don't know, we do have his picture, but we don't know whether he was perhaps with, well, we don't know what security outfit he was with. And, of course, that's something we're trying to find out.
So were you in, detained?
Yeah, I was arrested. And brought to, well, given over to the D.C. police and spent the next 3.5 hours in jail, mugshotted, fingerprinted, you know, the whole deal, allowed one call and that kind of stuff. They released me at dusk and said, okay, you're on your own. And I had to take a cab to the nearest hospital and I went to the ER and they, you know, X-rayed my wrists, which were badly torn, and and I had bruises all over my my upper arms and in some places that I couldn't show on TV.
You were given a call the last time I was arrested there and stayed in jail for 52 hours. We were told that that's only on TV, where people only get calls on TV.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that's what we were told the last time we were arrested.
Well, I feel privileged then. I called my wife, but luckily she didn't get the message until I was out, so she didn't have to worry at all.
So I know there's been a lot of online activity to petition the State Department for an apology. Have you heard anything from the State Department since then?
Well, sort of ironically, I tuned into Democracy Now! On my way down to the studio this morning, and I heard a clip by Hillary Clinton saying, it's terrible for government security people to treat people harshly and to use violence against them, and they should be called to account. And I'm saying, wow, you know, those Veterans for Peace with whom I'm so proud to associate, they got to her. She's going to apologize. And then I realized she's talking about Bahrain.
Well, and I, right after it happened and the video got sent out, I commented that it sounded, what happened to you sounded like a lot similar to what happened to me when I was arrested at the State of the Union speech for having a Veterans for Peace t-shirt.
Yeah.
So Yes, there's definitely a double standard hypocrisy going on between what the U.S. government says and what the U.S. government does.
Yeah, I was talking to a person today that sees a metaphor in all this, and you really have to read Clinton's speech to see what she was saying at precisely the time the goons were taking me out, and then three paragraphs later when she rips Iran apart by saying that, you know what they do? They follow protesters, they arrest them, and then they use violence against them. You know,
well, that sounds like every experience I've ever had in this country.
It sounds like something out of Franz Kafka, you know?
Oh, Ray, what's your next step? What's going to happen in the future about this incident?
Sure. Well, the arresting officer, I think a little sheepishly, said, Mr. McGovern, we're going to charge you with three things, unlawful entry, resisting arrest, and what's unruly conduct or disruptive conduct or whatever. Now, the first one we're not going to do because you were right. You told us that you had a ticket, and you did, so unlawful entry won't work. The other one we're just not going to do, and I'm sure she was thinking about all those cameras that captured what happened to me, you know. There was no resistance. I didn't have time to resist the thing. And the third one, disorderly conduct, well, I'm going to have to go to trial for that. And and that's the criminal procedure that you and I know in this capital, and we'll just see what happens. I don't know what they could adduce as proof that I was guilty. There was disorderly conduct, that's for sure, but it wasn't in my initiative.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for keeping the pressure on and for not giving up and always standing up for peace and for
justice. Well, I'm only following the example of a nice woman that I know named Cindy Sheehan, so thank you.
Well, I just want my listeners to know that you and I have been friends since way before Crawford, Texas, and that, you know, that friendship has always meant a lot to me, especially times like this when, you know, I'm just so proud to know you and what you do and what you keep doing. Is there some way that my listeners can, contribute to a legal defense fund or get a hold of you, or do you have a website that they can access?
Well, I write for consortiumnews.com, but, you know, the short answer, Cindy, is that I was incredibly fortunate when I got out of the jail. I called Brian Becker, and Brian works with an incredibly talented small law firm, which is actually a nonprofit. And they were interested in helping me, and so when I asked about their fees, they said, there are no fees. We do this because we pursue justice here, and if we win settlements, as they have many times in the past, we charge for, you know, we take the fees out of that. So I'm in very good hands, and I'm delighted to be able to say that.
Well, Ray, keep us posted, and hopefully we can have you back on soon with some good news and good progress.
Thanks, Cindy. Adelante.
Okay, Ray. We love you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That was our dear friend, Ray McGovern, ex-CIA agent and current peace advocate. And he was arrested in a speech that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave this past week at George Washington University. Well, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. I know I did. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, and you especially for listening. I hope you tune back in next week. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.